Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for letting me be here. And for this great... Well, the organizers probably listened to this through the microphone, so it should be okay. So this is a tough slot because people have enough ammunition to throw at me. So I brought my own, but it's not going to last for all of you. So I really had great fun recently with the Schrödinger's equation, which is what I'd like to share with you. And just before I start, there is an S2PH thing which just came out this week where you can read about the details. And I already found it submitted, so that's for so. Okay, so let's step back a little bit before we go into Schrödinger equations, just so we see how this fits into the big picture of things. And what I'm saying is, you all know this, is just to get the big picture. So the mother of all equations which are used in this field is the Boltzmann's equation. So if I use the Microsoft Equation Editor, I would just stop here. But here I can write it out. So this is zero. And so basically all this tells you is that...
I can't read. What's that for the gradient symbol?
Oh, it's the potential.
Phi.
Yeah. So...
That's P over M after the other...
Yeah. So if you consider this equation as a function of P, X, and T, it's a seven... It has seven... variables, and of course you could consider it as V, X, and T, and there's all many ways of writing it. But the point is that this just expresses phase space conservation, and basically almost all equations you could use in this field can be derived from this. And if you're into naming equations, this is called collisionless Boltzmann equation strictly if this field is an external field, and it's called the Vlasov equation if this field is actually depending on F, as it does in the case of gravitational problem, because essentially this is gravitational potential which depends essentially on F in a nonlinear way. So then it's a nonlinear equation and it's really hard to solve. Okay, and the first, and I guess this is the only one this is the only one I will actually write out. The first equation you can get from this by taking velocity moment is the Euler's equation. So there are many ways to solve this equation. I guess the best way is to use an n-body simulation, which can be considered as solving the characteristics of this equation. But for analytical studies, the most successful, I guess, so far has been the Euler's equation. And the way you get it is that essentially you take this kind of velocity moment. So first moment, second moment, and so on. And without going into details, it's the usual equations. And I now write them in expanding universe. So.
It's a gradient.
Sorry?
Isn't that a gradient?
Yeah, there is a gradient. So you can get these equations from those by taking velocity moment. And essentially, this is just continuity equation. This is, strictly speaking, Euler's equation. And this is Poisson's equation. And this is already in the expanding universe. And
rho is the density and delta is the perturbation.
Delta is the perturbation of the density. And basically, this equation formed the basis of the most successful perturbation theory approach. So there is all kinds of things people calculated. And when I go to the other blackboard and I do my own calculation, almost basically everything I did has a counterpart for this equation as well. And the most important thing to note about this equation is that compared to this original equation, since we took velocity moments, and we assume here that there is a unique velocity at each point in space in this formulation, it actually breaks down at shell crossing, because when you have shell crossing, there is no unique velocity. And also, on this side of the equation, you could use some kind of anisotropic pressure, which could help some, at least to first degree, could help some of these problems. But basically, these are the equations mainly people use, and they explicitly break down on small scales. So even perturbation theory is extremely successful on these equations, in fact, better than you would expect. But it has to break down simply because the equations don't describe the dynamics anymore correctly. By this, sorry?
And we're assuming the motion is non-relativistic?
Yes. So we are all, this is all Newtonian limit, which is a very good approximation on the scales we are considering. So we consider scales much smaller than the Hubble length, but much bigger than a Schwarzschild radius of any collapsed objects. Okay? So this equation there, and this contains everything. But it's very hard to solve. So let me, before I go into the approach I'm introducing, there are other approaches connected with this equation. You can derive from these equations the BBKGY equations, which essentially calculate endpoint statistics. And the time derivative of the endpoint statistic, so it's kind of like this distribution function, but it's now the distribution of the joint distribution of n particles, their velocities and their positions. But the nth order distribution function, its derivative is related to the integral of the n plus 1's order distribution. So in many fields in physics, you can easily close this equation in plasma physics, for instance, because of the short range interactions. But here, it is not obvious how to close. There are some attempts in the literature, but the BBKGY equation appears to be as hard as these equations. Okay? There's another approach complementary to this, which again I don't talk much about, is the Lagrangian approach. The Lagrangian approach, just try it. Essentially, it looks at the path of particle, where q is its initial position, and x is its final position, and this psi qt is the transformation between q and x. And essentially, you can write down the equation of motion in these coordinates, and you find essentially that the Jacobian of this transformation is essentially related to the density, and then do perturbation theory just like you do here. The orders are slightly different, but I would say it's equally successful. But this is, I guess, the most standard. So I'm not talking about this. And then there are... In principle, you could, But once you introduce the connection with the determinant of this transformation being the delta, actually it also breaks down at shell crossing. You can show it. So the usual formulation of it at least is not working beyond shell crossing.
We just have to add the Jacobian at different places that correspond to
the same. Yeah, I guess so. But it hasn't been done anyway. And then there are all kinds of nonlinear approximations, which I don't want to go into too much, but there's the adhesion approximation, which essentially adds another term here artificially just to regularize the nonlinear equations. There's the Zadovich approximation, which essentially, it's actually the first Lagrangian perturbation theory. There is second order Lagrangian, and so on. There is frozen flux approximation, linear potential approximation. They all essentially, these latter ones essentially try to replace Poisson's equation with something simpler, usually. So linear potential, for instance, replaces this equation with just a linear value of the potential.
These are always problems with gravity and nothing else.
We are only talking about dust and gravity in the expanding. No, nothing. And so now there is an interesting alternative to all of this, what we are talking about, which was introduced by Nick Kaiser and Widrow, actually, or the paper is actually Widrow and Kaiser in 93, which is to use the correspondence limit of the Schrödinger's equation to describe Boltzmann's equation. And okay, the Schrödinger equation, as we all know. I guess maybe I should call the potential V here just because it's too similar to psi. And what can be shown actually is that
equals zero.
Yeah. Thank you. So what can be and of course again we have Poisson's equation. So what can be shown that this equation, actually, I mean, it's physically obvious that in the correspondence limits, they have to be kind of the same because this evolves this psi field and that evolves that F distribution. But actually, you can also show, if you're into naming things, there is this thing called Huzimi coherent state representation, which essentially you just smooth this this psi function with a particular kernel function, and then which is equivalent to expanding this representation. And then if you take the resulting smooth function, then you can show that in the scale range where the de Broglie wavelengths is smaller than the scales you consider, then this equation is equivalent to that equation. So Widrow and Kaiser has shown it, but regarding the reference, it's 1940 Huzimi, so probably it was shown already a long time ago. They are the first who used it for astrophysics, I guess.
So it's not obvious to me at first thought whether it's psi or psi squared that should be identified with the distribution.
Psi squared, is there some simple
argument? Psi squared
is not F, right?
Psi squared is not F. Psi squared is the density rho. And that's the density.
Yeah. So what's F? So F is the density in phase space, not in position space.
Yeah. So essentially. Yeah.
So what are we supposed to think of as F in the Schrödinger?
So essentially, the way to think about it, actually, there is approximately the wave function is something like square root of rho times e to the I theta x over h bar, where theta x, this is the simplest case, theta x is the velocity potential. So if you again, I don't want to go into this, but if you do the usual things, for instance, you try to calculate a current, then you can show that this phase is acts like the velocity potential.
For instance, general cultural background, this formulation is exactly what's used in superconductivity.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Ginsburg lambda wave function.
Yeah, and yes, there is. I was going to mention actually Ginsburg lambda because actually another. It turns out that another alternative approach to this kind of quantum formulation was recently put forward by Jones and then Peter Kohs, where they simply looked at this equation, which, you know, if you're naming this, can be thought of as Bernoulli equation if you replace velocity with velocity potential. And then when it's a Bernoulli equation, depending on what terms you add here, for instance, if you add adhesion term, it becomes Berger's equation. If you add slightly different terms, it becomes random heat equation, Landau-Ginzburg equation, Anderson equation, and what else? Well, Bernoulli is just the usual Bernoulli equation,
except
I guess.
In superconductivity, there's some physical input in that rho is assumed to be what they call rigid. In other words, rho is approximately incompressible or slowly varying fluid. Well, here I guess it's not.
I think the approximation is a good way to answer, right?
It is.
What is rho? I don't see.
The rho you run under the square root.
Ah, yes, that's rho here is the actual density of the field. So this equation you could, so what Widrow and Kaiser did actually, they used this equation and they created an alternative method to embody simulation. What they did is that they used these equations and essentially this equation was used to create initial conditions, something similar to this. And basically, you want to start a cosmological embodied simulation with some initial density and velocity, and this is how they could put in initial density and velocity. But this is not, I don't know what you mean by rigid, but...
Well, in other words, the whole formalism doesn't work if rho is very rapidly varying. So
I guess that...
Compared to theta. In other words, if you were to take the... Trying to get the velocity by taking the gradient of psi, you want the velocity to be only due to theta. But of course, when you take a gradient, you also get some changes in rho coming in. So
yeah.
Rho must be relatively slow varying in some sense.
I guess that must be true in this case as well. But in some fairly rigorous mathematical sense, these equations are equivalent to these equations, and Widrow and Kaiser did show that they could create embody simulations which actually match the results of a conventional embody simulation. So they actually implemented embody simulations which use this formalism.
With this identification you wrote down below?
With this kind of, yes, essentially the identification that rho is psi squared, and I guess this is the initial conditions were slightly different from this because they actually, instead of using a velocity potential, they also put in some kind of error, if you like. But so you can be more general than this because velocity potential might not exist. But this is just, I'm trying to give you the simplest interpretation of the formula. And I guess the rigorous interpretation is this Husimi representation, which actually shows that the two equations are equivalent.
So there's nothing which is exactly F?
No, there's nothing which is exactly F, that's true. F is only in an expansion, and in this Husimi representation there is a length scale which has to be carefully chosen, where it's bigger, much bigger than the de Broglie wavelengths, and much smaller than your box size if you're talking about the simulation. So there is nothing which is exactly f. In an expansion, the first term of this expansion is this equation, and there are other terms which are much smaller because they've with scale as this smoothing length scale divided by L squared, essentially. So there is always.
Does it mean we don't have the full phase space information? Because when you think of the Schrodinger equation, you do have, I mean, in some x and p are complementary there. But I mean, here when you have f, you have the full phase space information.
Here also you have, that's the whole point, that somehow psi very elegantly unites the phase space, the space and velocity information.
Can you give us a physical intuition why? Because when you write it down in that form as square root of rho, you think it's already integrated over the phase space. I mean, at least the momentum part.
Yeah, but the phase contains, essentially, the phase of the wave function is like the velocity, and the amplitude of the wave function squared is like the density, but it's not exactly
when
that.
When it's relatively rigid.
And it's supposed to be equivalent in this to this equation.
Well, with psi, you can still calculate all the moments of f. So, in that sense.
Well, of course, in real quantum mechanics, p and x cannot be defined at the same time, so you can't talk about every moment.
Yeah. But really, I mean. So the interesting, there's two comments. Obviously, here we use quantum mechanics only as a tool to solve these equations, but there is an interesting implication if you wanted to describe some exotic dark matter which has very large Compton wavelengths, you might want to use this formulation. There might be some wavy effects for a dark matter which is very large. But anyway, I'm not talking about this. It's just one of the many possibilities.
If I want to know the small scale velocity dispersion, mm-hmm. how would I calculate that from psi?
If you want to do what?
Small scale velocity dispersion.
Mm-hmm. I think you would have to go through essentially what you have to go then. If you have a simulation, then you would have to go, you would have to calculate this thing which Peter and Kaiser calls F, which is similar to this. And that's essentially kind of a convolution of this psi with this appropriate smoothing function. And then with this F, you can integrate. You can essentially do, you can calculate averages just like you would calculate averages with this F, if that's what you really want to do.
Is it possible to do something you can sometimes do in quantum mechanics, which is construct a Wigner function with a wave function? Mm-hmm. And so you construct this sort of pseudo phase space density, probability density, so you can probably get that.
I frankly, I don't know because I haven't tried it, and I just took this equation as my starting point. And but I think this Huzimi representation is actually similar to that because it's essentially this function convolved with a smoothing, and you have to square it. I think it's vaguely similar. I didn't look through whether it's exactly the same in some limit on some, you know, this naming of equation actually is an interesting game, but I was not that much into it. I wanted to actually calculate something which which has a result in the end, a number. And so anyway. So now,
I'm sorry, one more question.
Okay.
Maybe you'll cover it in what you're going to do next, but I'm a little bit puzzled when you said that that they ran a simulation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would run a simulation to try to integrate those equations,
yeah.
But
in order to integrate these equations, I also have to run a simulation? Is that the, I don't quite understand.
I mean, these are again nonlinear equations, right? If you simply want to solve them, just like solving these equations, you need to numerically solve them, and that's a simulation. You solve these equations by using an n-body simulation, right? To solve these equations, you actually grid the configuration space, and you just solve them numerically. And of course, you could try to do the same here, except here that would be a six-dimensional configuration space. Here, it is a complex three-dimensional configuration space, and that's the whole idea why it is worth to try using this equation as opposed to those equations. And I think, I don't know, if you're asking simulations, I haven't seen many papers which actually use Schrödinger simulations, so I don't know whether this ever developed beyond a cute idea in terms of simulations. Because,
isn't this the same as the Thomas Fermi atom? Using gravity instead of Coulomb, you know, attractive gravity instead of repulsive Coulomb.
I guess, but again,
because Thomas Fermi made the same approximation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'd like to get into the actual calculation. So if you use, so you have to write here a 3/2 h psi. You add a term to describe expanding universe, okay? And in that you have to replace this with your rho background delta, where delta is essentially psi average squared minus the average psi squared, okay? But so this is the starting point of my equations. And then, so I'm introducing a transformation psi RT equal to psi naught to the minus 3/2 times a to the a rt plus I b rt over h bar. And I guess this transformation is probably saying what you said about rigidity. If I'm doing perturbation theory in this variable, this is why I'm saying that probably you're right. This is kind of like, if I understand correctly what you mean by rigidity, then this transformation that we are perturbing things in this variable is kind of like rigidity, I guess. And so if you, but in any case, I always have the right to parameterize my equations this way, and this is what I get. So now I take, so originally I had one complex equation. I will have two real equations. A dot equals minus 1 over 2ma squared still have my Poisson equation. So this is just a new parametrization, and I want to do perturbation theory of this equation. And if you look at these equations, they are structurally not much. They don't seem to be much tougher than these equations. So first of all, I will throw away these wavy terms. I will put h bar equals 0 after this. So in a sense, I'm doing that because I'm simply doing that because I'm not interested in any wavy features. I'm just interested. If I think about the simulation, it doesn't matter to me as long as I'm above the Broglie wavelengths, I don't care what's happening below. And that's, so I'm completely forgetting about these. If you did a simulation, you could say that the de Broglie wavelengths is a typical momentum over h bar. So it's essentially, it depends on the velocities, right? And your mass. So it's actually an adjustable parameter, but I don't care. Next, I will set m equals 1, and I'm throwing away these terms.
I just don't completely see why you
can. I mean, if I can always choose an m, that these terms are always small compared to any other term, why couldn't I just throw these away?
Well, he can try it and see if it works. I mean, if the answer he gets out.
And the answer I'm getting out is.
No, just because you get the answer right doesn't mean that the kicker is
missing.
That's not the right.
That's what you're doing, that UKB.
This is basically
the UKB. Yeah, UKB. You mean that is the WKB?
I assume.
Yes, it is
the
yeah.
Okay, then it's okay.
Okay, so I see that for this crowd, the naming of equations is very important. So I think I call this equation the Humu Humu Nuku Nuku Apua A equation, because that's the Hawaiian state fish which surfs the waves. So I don't know.
This one, if I replace the A variable, you know, you need to do A, 2a minus 1 with delta, so that it looks like that equation on the left-hand side. Can I write the gradients of b at flight velocity so that this whole equation just look very much like those, except with one correction term or something like that?
Yes, it does look very similar to those equations, but I don't like to do that because I actually like the fact that I'm expanding the log of the field. Why do I like that fact? Because it is well known that the galaxy density field remains very close to log normal on small scales even. And log normal means that it's Gaussian in log space. So the fact that I'm using the log of the field in my expansion is a great feature, because it means that it's a field which is close to Gaussian, so my expansion has much more chance to succeed than actually in the original variable. So I don't want to do that, at least at this point. I actually want to use this. And again, if you're into naming equations, taking the log of the field is often called the Hopf-Cohl transformation, I found out. But again, hi, Dick. it doesn't really matter. The point is, I take this parametrization of the wave function, and indeed, for the density field, essentially, the density field is the log of my A field, which is good. I really like that. It is possible to try what you're suggesting, but I do, this is the first thing I tried anyway, and it seemed to work. And it's a good feature, I think, that I'm using the log of the field.
Well, I'm asking not really for the purpose of calculations, but for purpose of understanding, you know, this set of equations, supposedly it should include everything, shell crossing.
Yeah. Right? It's very...
So if I express, try to express it in terms that are as close to that as possible.
It is very auspicious that if you look at, for instance, this equation without the wavy term, it's almost the same equation you would get here if you introduced the velocity potential. And the first equation is also very similar. And when we do the perturbation theory solution of this, it is extremely similar to what you would get from Euler's equation. This might explain the fact that perturbation theory works better than expected. Simply the equation is very similar. But as far as I can tell, these equations are more general than the Euler's equations because I never took the moments of the original Boltzmann equation. So in principle, it has the chance of penetrating nonlinear regime more than Euler's equation. Okay.
Is it true if you assume the flow is potential flow, then mm-hmm. this set of equations will be exactly the same as the, if it's potential flow?
It will never be exactly the same because this continuity equation, which is kind of like this equation, is not exactly the same. It's similar but not exactly. And I can elucidate this when I do the perturbation theory because the actual recursion relation you get from this equation is very similar, but not exactly the same as from Euler's equation. So anyway, the point is, if you look at these equations structurally, they are not much harder than those equations, except for this exponential. But if you are doing perturbation theory, we can always expand the exponential as well. So from here on, what I'm doing is what people usually do for these equations. I'm simply using the same machinery. So I assume that, by the way, the interesting feature which makes this whole approach possible is that if I'm throwing away the wavy terms, then the equations become homogeneous in A and H. And so I can use the following assumption, AK. ANK times A to the M. By the way, I'm using omega equals 1. I'm using omega equals 1 because it's very simple to do analytically. And you could do everything with arbitrary cosmology, but for now, I don't care. I'm using omega equals 1. And if I used different omega, I would have here a slightly different assumption. But so if I'm using these assumptions, so essentially this is the nth order perturbative expansion of AK.
Can I go back to Lamb's question? Sorry for jumping in. Mm-hmm. Are you really setting H bar equal to 0?
Yeah, I'm destroying those terms.
Then why isn't that just the classical limit?
That is a classical limit, but it's not.
What is the extra piece in the equation that shouldn't be already there, which is, I guess, what your question was? I mean, why isn't it identical?
Because I never took the moments of the Boltzmann equation. To derive these equations from the Boltzmann equation, you take moments of it. I never took the moments of the Boltzmann equation. I used the equation which is equivalent to the Boltzmann equation, which is the Schrödinger equation, and I never took moments. I simply introduced this parametrization of the field.
You're nodding your head.
No, I'm nodding my head.
That means you agree.
No, I agree with, I think, it's because if you do quantum mechanics and you can construct this pseudo phase space density in terms of the wave function, it's called the Wigner function, which on near the De Bruyne wavelength, it isn't a phase space, it doesn't have enough properties, but on in the classical regime, it looks like a phase space distribution. And so you can, in some sense, reconstruct a phase space distribution from the wave function in the classical limit. But you can't do that, right? It's what he's saying. That over there is in terms of moments over the phase space.
This is a restricted equation. The fact that the
treating this as an n body system, you're treating it as a single response to phi.
Yeah.
So I don't really see.
But this phi is like this f here. This f is also a single function, but this equation here describes everything, right? This is the phase space density. It's one function. Essentially, psi here acts as if it was some kind of phase space density. At least in the correspondence limit, this psi is a phase space density.
Yeah, so that is the classical limit of that distribution.
Exactly.
Well, there's one. Well, therefore,
but those are moments of the distribution.
Exactly.
But that's the classical distribution function. Yeah.
Exactly.
So by taking h part as zero and ignoring the wave terms, he's getting a classical distribution.
Right. And I think B is basically the action.
B is at least in the beginning, if you have a potential flow initial condition, it's kind of like the velocity potential. That's exactly what Nick told me. If I show this to Dick, he will say it's the Hamilton Jacobi, and it's exactly what you said. Meeting of great minds.
He set you up.
And
there's one big approximation that's made in these kind of methods, which is that psi in real quantum mechanics is, of course, a function of all the different variables in the problem. So if you have 10 particles, it's a function of 10 variables. And by making it a function of one variable, you've neglected correlations. That's the meaning of the second equation here. So, you know, this other workshop that's going on in parallel to ours, correlations with electrons, that's about that whole subject, what happens when you look at the approximation.
Sure. But that's also true. That's a single particle distribution function.
Yeah.
You haven't written multi-particle correlations. Yeah.
This equation also a single particle function. The PBKGY equations are the ones which contain multi-particle functions, but actually they can be obtained also from this equation. So I guess in classical limit it should be okay.
You're just as much ignoring multi-particle correlations in that equation.
Yeah. So what I forgot to write here is actually that before I did this, I Fourier transformed this equation. So AK dot is equal to minus. And I said that M equals 1. I just set M to 1. Sorry for the mess. I guess I have to invent a notation here. I know how to write this. I actually wrote in my paper as the nth power of this thing, and I wrote in words that this is understood as convolution, but maybe it's a bit confusing notation, but basically, what I did, I expanded this exponential, I Fourier transformed this whole set of equations. I expanded this exponential and also used the Poisson's equation. So I have now two equations. And now I can use these very similar assumptions that you use when you solve Euler's equation to obtain a perturbation theory series expansion. Okay, and now what you get is n times, oops, I have to write one more thing, going too fast. So I also assume that AKN is written as some kernel function. Fn k1 kn times a1 k1. So the first order and I take n of the first order solution in Fourier space and I integrate it through a kernel function fn. This is the form of the solution I assume. And similarly for bk, it is the same kind of assumption. And another set of kernel functions, EKN. And if you went through perturbation theory of the Euler's equation, then you notice that what I'm doing is exactly what is being done in Euler's for those equations. Okay. So now I get these recursions, which for the Euler's equations were first obtained by Gorov et al., and special cases were already dealt with before by Peebles and Fry people. So you can prove that with these assumptions, you get the following. So these are the recursion relations, and the coupling alpha is Q1 times Q2 divided by Q2 squared. Beta is K squared times Q1 Q2 over Q1 squared Q2 squared. Now, the interesting thing that if you were to do the same thing for these equations, you would get almost exactly the same recursion here, except with two differences. One, the first coupling constant alpha, instead of Q1, I didn't tell you what Q1 is, but basically Q1 is the sum of the arguments of these functions, and Q2 is the sum of the arguments of these of the second thing in the sum. Here, you would actually have, and k is the sum of all the arguments. Instead of q1, you would have k for the coupling. You wouldn't have this 2, but that's just because actually I have 2a, so that's not a big difference. And the second difference is that here, you have only the m equals 1 term. If you look at the actual structure of the recursion relations, you can compare, and here you would have the m equals 1 term, and here you have a slightly different coupling. And other than that, it's a very similar recursion relation. And this is... So, this is the main result. From this you can calculate anything in this space, because once you have the,
Can I ask, Alpha and Beta are telling me how Fourier modes interact.
Couple, So essentially, Alpha is the coupling, roughly speaking. Okay, I tell you what Alpha and Beta mean in, for the Euler equation, because there it's clear. There, Alpha means the coupling of V and Delta, essentially. And Beta means the coupling of the, V with itself from this term. So roughly speaking, Alpha for the Euler equation comes from this term, and Beta comes from this term. And since the second equation is roughly speaking the same as the Euler equation, I actually get the same coupling exactly. Here I have a slightly different coupling, but the only difference is that instead of Q1, you would have K here.
So different modes are interacting.
So it's interesting that the log of the field is coupled. So this is, so A is the log of the field, B is the phase of the wave function. So what I'm saying is that the phase of the wave function and the amplitude of the wave function coupled very similarly as in Euler's equation, delta and V, but not exactly, just there's a subtle difference, apparently. That's the result of the calculation anyway.
Yeah, okay, so let's go back to Hamilton-Jacobi. Hamilton-Jacobi, V is basically grad V, that basically gives you that equation, I believe. And what I'm concerned about, no idea, whether there is some function of T that multiplies the V in the transformation to the velocity, right, so they become moving. If, you know, because you're putting that the A of T is time with a separability,
yeah, so
that there's no such term in the phase. Is that clear?
I think this is a very general parameterization, right? I can always parameterize a function like this. That I have the right to do that, I think.
And B is, yes, but you're treating B perturbatively?
I'm treating both A and B perturbatively. And that's, obviously, that's where there is an approximation. When you do perturbation theory, who knows what you're doing here, how far it will take you. That's, I fully admit. But that's true even for these equations, right? When you do perturbation theory, you're always in for, you might be in for a surprise. You never know how.
In what sense is this a different expansion than the usual expansion? Because as they said, this, if you said the gradient of B is U to B, I think this is should be probably exactly equivalent to that.
But it's not.
That's why I was worried about the A dot over A type terms, because they don't get reproduced here for reasons I don't understand.
Just because of this.
I think because it's scaled.
Transformation.
That's why I'm bringing that up, right? I mean, that's probably why you aren't getting an A over A.
But if you actually, if here you use conformal time instead of regular time, then you lose the A dot terms. And this, actually my statement about this, if I compare this, if I compare the recursions, the simplest way to derive it actually to use conformal time, because you lose the A dot terms there.
So in the usual expansion, it's an expansion in small delta and small V, basically.
Yeah.
This is an expansion.
This is much harder to interpret. I guess it's small A and small B.
That's right. So shouldn't it be the same
small variation of A?
Small variation, because there is a bulk which taken out here.
So in what sense is this a different expansion from the user expansion?
It's different because it's obtained from a different equation. And it's also...
But this other equation is the same as those in...
Not exactly.
Flow. For potential flow it is, I think.
No.
It seems to me that.
Well, you see that the coupling here is different, and also...
I agree in the general case where you have shell crossing, this is more general. This is contained thing that doesn't have. But if it's just potential flow, I would think that should be the same. And in fact, you can kind of see it. Right?
I guess it has to be the same in the limit where, you know, I will show that the results I get, if I expand them for very large scales, I get the exact same results that you would get from those equations. So I guess that must be true. I mean, there is no, I mean, it describes the same physics. So in the limit, when they describe the same physics, they have to be the same. But that doesn't, I mean, that's obvious, right?
Right, but the novel thing you're doing is somehow you're finding an expansion in some smart parameters that's slightly different from the usual.
Exactly.
But what is that? What is that expansion? I'm just trying to understand.
Essentially, in terms of the density, I'm expanding in the log of the field instead of the field itself. So A is kind of like the log. So the normal expansion is in delta, right? My expansion is in 1/2 ln 1 plus delta. That's a big difference. And ln 1 plus delta is much... Perhaps, and that's the idea of the Hopf-Cole transformation. When you take the log of the field and you write the equation, I'm not saying that the Schroeder equation is essential here, because I'm throwing away, this is how I did it, and I'm sure, you know, somebody will figure out a way of doing it without the Schroeder equation, because I'm here in the correspondence limit, so there must be a purely traditional mechanical way of doing exactly the same thing. Somehow, technically, it was much simpler to do it this way. And that's why I'm using Schrödinger equation. I mean, in Hawaii, you know, waves, Schrödinger equation rules. I mean, you can't hold that against me. So I'm deleting this because there's no more space to write. So now I can actually calculate these kernels, right? So my F2 kernel is 3/7 plus 10/7 times alpha plus 2/7 times beta, which is very similar, obviously, to the Euler kernel, right? If you remember, there's always these 3/7 floating around, right? So it's very similar. Now, if you want to do, say, so basically these kernels, what they do, if you just think about the density, because that's easier to interpret than the phase of the wave function. In terms of the density, what they do, you can calculate with these kernels essentially nth order moments of this, the log of the field instead of delta. And obviously, when delta is small, the log 1 plus delta is delta, so it's the same as calculating the moments of delta. On small scales where delta is big, this log acts as a compression. Essentially, even when delta is big, the log delta is still fairly small. So this is why I hope that this might penetrate perturbation theory, might penetrate nonlinear regimes deeper, right? And also we know that log 1 plus delta is log normally distributed, so the whole thing is Gaussian in log space. So that's another reason why I think this is a good expansion. So essentially, if you want to calculate with this kernel the first non-trivial thing, that would be, and now I want to compare with, so obviously I can calculate essentially with this the three-point function of the log of the field and things like that in this expansion. But first I want to expand my results back to real delta space to compare with the results coming from the equations which I deleted, right? So it turns out that if I expand delta 1 is 2a1, and delta 2 is 2a2 plus a1 squared. So now, if I plug these a's into this, this is essentially what you use if you calculate skewness or bispectrum or any three-point quantity. If I plug these A's in, I find that the condition that I would get in this, so remember, this is an expansion. I expand delta in terms of A's. in this order of the expansion to get the same result as from regular perturbation theory is that my F2, 1 plus my F2 should be equal to 2 times F2, where this is the same kernel obtained from Euler's equation. And in fact, this is the case. You can just see that if I add 1 to this kernel and divide by 2, I get exactly back the Eulerian kernel. So this means that if I expand my results to second order, but remember, I can calculate the, say, the three-point function of the log of the field, which is a very non-Gaussian thing. But if I expand this to the appropriate order, I do get back exactly any bispectrum three-point function, skewness, anything you want. In particular, now what I can do is the other trick of angular averaging these kernels. It turns out that if you angular average these kernels, then you can get essentially the angular averaged kernels, which are defined as n factorial times fn, for instance, for nu n. And nu n is n factorial times gn. So what I have to do, I have to angular average these equations. And to cut a long story short, that's a big difference between Euler in this case, that the angular average of this actually is zero, while the same coupling in Euler would be one. And the angular average of this is 2/3, which is the same as you would have in the case of Euler. So my first equation, this doesn't even contribute. So what I get, though my first equation is this n times nu n equal to mu n. Very simple equation. The second one is very complicated. It's essentially just a recursion for in fact, I'm deleting these now because so the second term is 3 times n factorial times sum m equals 2 m minus 2 over n factor times sum s1 sm delta m equals sum se nu 1 over S1 factor, nu 2 over S2 factor, and so on. Now, actually, this is interesting to compare with the kernels you get from regular perturbation theory. So now I'm deleting this, so no more contention on the basics. So in that case, nu n equal to sum over m, nu m over 2n plus 3 over n minus 1 times 2n plus 1, nu n minus m plus 2/3, nu n minus m. And there is another similar equation for. I just want you to see that it's very different. And the first equation is this extremely simple one. The second is much more complicated than any of these two. Okay. To cut the long story short, I can calculate my mu n's. And for instance, mu 2 is 26 21st, mu 3 is 568, 189, and so on. And then from this, I can calculate this quantity SA3, for instance, which is 26 sevenths. That's the skewness of my A field. Okay. Now, I can again expand my results into regular delta space, right? And the way to expand it is essentially I can expand it simplest way using the formalism of biasing. I assume that delta equals 2 to the 2a minus 1. And if you remember the biasing formula, I can look at this as delta galaxy and some underlying field. And there's a calculation by Frank and Gastanier which exactly tells you how the cumulants are transformed if you do this kind of transformation. So if I do that, and I transform my 26.7, but remember, this is an expansion which has infinite orders. The zeroth order for S3, now for the regular field, is 34.7. But in principle, I can go further in this expansion. In other words, so far I did three-level perturbation theory in log space, but three-level perturbation theory in log space is infinite order partial loop corrections in real space. And to show that, I actually did the calculation for the simplest thing you can get, and that is sigma squared. So obviously, the first order term in the expansion, sigma squared, will be just sigma squared itself. But then I have a second order term, S3A over 2 times sigma squared to the fourth. So this is loop correction, which comes simply from my three-level calculation. Now, if you've seen how these loop collections are calculated, these are very, very thick papers, and it's really complicated. And the exact result for this number is 1.82. I get 1.86 from my calculation. So it's within 2% of the true loop corrections. Or true loop corrections in the sense that, of course, the loop corrections based on Euler's theory, nothing tells that the loop corrections have to be now the same exactly in my theory, which is a little bit more general. But in any case, my three-level perturbation theory contains incomplete loop correction in the regular delta field, and it seems that this is very close to complete. Basically, the dominant parts are just from this transformation, and perhaps if I did loop correction as well in log space and then I project it down, maybe I would get very small additional terms. But the point is that with a very simple calculation, I could reproduce something very complicated just because my expansion is in log space. And but anyway, this is only the second order expansion of my result. My result contains infinite orders, which of course would be horribly complicated to get with the regular perturbation theory. And it's a miracle that from this equation, which is very different from these, when you actually do the calculation and then fold in to another complicated equation, which is relating the cumulants in these two different spaces, does give the exact same kind of zeros order results. And I check this up to S5 now, that if I expand my results, so up to S4, so far this is all, by the way, paper and pencil theory, which was really fun to do. S5, to do this formula up to fifth order, I already needed mathematical. But I think some good old timers could have calculated this with hand, but I was not able. I always used mathematical. But up to S4, I could actually do the calculation by hand.
Do you compare with the loop power spectrum?
I haven't yet. The only thing I did still, that I also looked at smoothing, so I can tell you the result that my S3A in this space is 26 sevenths minus n plus 2 times n plus 3 times 2. So this is my smoothed result. And again, if I fold this down with the projection, I get, lo and behold, 34 7 minus n plus 3, which is the correct perturbation theory, Euler perturbation theory result. However, if I now use this S3 smooth and I put it in, I actually retrieve, so this was perturbation theory result for n equals minus 3, which is unsmoothed, essentially. It's the same as unsmoothed. If I plug in the smoothed value of my S3A here in my second order expansion, I actually get back all loop corrections which were calculated within a few percent. So for n equals minus 2, I get whatever 0.8 something, and the result again is within few percent if I use my smoothed S3 here. So actually the whole thing seems to be working pretty well, and obviously time is out, so there is lots of things you can do. So far, only thing I did this calculation. I have the most general results. I can calculate virtually anything in this space with the same methods as were used in the other space, and I have shown how the connection, what is the relation of my calculation with the old calculation. That is, in fact, my tree-level theory contains loop correction simply because it's expanding a nonlinear function of the field itself. And actually, what exactly the B field means is an interesting question. But so that's it. So.